From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Today, I'm announcing that that I'm seeking the Green Party nomination for president in order to emphasize a pro-democracy campaign and to recognize that many of the problems in this country cannot be resolved without specific strengthening of the tools of democracy.
Ralph Nader announces for president. And we speak with the roommate of Amadou Diallo. We'll hear what wasn't said on the stand about the hours after Amadou Diallo was killed, why the roommates were brought to the police station and questioned about who could have killed him. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a clear endorsement of President Mohammad Khatami, Iranian voters rejected Iran's hardliners, giving reformists the largest number of seats in parliament. With most results known, Friday's vote was likely to strengthen Khatami's hand in pushing social, cultural, and political reforms. Since coming to power in 1997, the president has advocated dismantling many restrictions imposed by the 21-year-old Islamic order. About 83% of Iran's close to 40 million eligible voters turned out to cast ballots. As of today, reformists had won 137 of the 290 seats in parliament. Trying to rebound from his loss in South Carolina, John McCain is taking on George W. Bush in Michigan. On the stump there, where another important primary is on tap, McCain has labeled Bush a big spender, then declared, if he's a reformer, I'm an astronaut. McCain calls Tuesday's primary round three in the battle for Republican presidential nomination. He says, we won round one in New Hampshire, and Governor Bush won round two in South Carolina. Now we go to round three. McCain has a tricky task trying to underscore his conservative credentials at the same time trying to undercut Bush's claim of being a reformer. And the Arizona senator has to do it while upholding his pledge to run a positive campaign. Meanwhile, consolidation of Republican primary polling places across South Carolina caused voter confusion and prompted demands from John McCain for an investigation. McCain's campaign complained that precincts that were supposed to be open were closed. The Arizona senator demanded, quote, a full investigation after discovering the Pond Branch voting precinct in Greenville was closed. Campaign manager Rick Davis said there were no plans to sue. In Washington, NAACP President Kwasi Mfume said representatives of the civil rights group had received complaints Saturday morning that some polling places in heavily black areas were closed. He said he would send a representative to South Carolina after the polls closed to investigate the charges. In response to a lawsuit, the South Carolina Republican Party promised last week to open all state-designated polling places and, if necessary, pay state election workers to staff them. Two Democrats had sued and complained to the Justice Department that the GOP's practice of not opening all polling places, especially in predominantly black areas, violates federal law. Tonight's debate at New York's Apollo Theater will go on after all. A planned stagehand strike that threatened a presidential debate between Democrats Al Gore and Bill Bradley was called off yesterday. Theater management and the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees reached an agreement just after dawn. Both candidates had vowed not to cross a picket line at the theater. Union workers were without a contract since September. They announced Saturday they would strike at noon today, hours before the scheduled debate, unless they had a new deal. The Bradley-Gore debate, focusing on race and urban issues, is the only one scheduled in New York before the state's March 7th presidential primary. Hundreds of protesters have freed the 65 policemen they captured during a clash over control of a teacher's college in Mexico City. Several police and protesters were injured during the weekend protest in the Hidalgo state town of Tetepec. 50 miles north of Mexico City. Protesters also burned more than a dozen police cars. The latest violence began as hundreds of state police raided the school early Saturday morning to end a seven-week student takeover. Dozens of students were arrested. The school has long been a hotbed of political activism, and many town residents apparently supported the students' demands for more scholarships and the removal of a few school administrators they accused of corruption. And this news from here in New York, the defense resumes its case tomorrow in the trial of the three New York City police officers charged with conspiring to cover up the torture of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima in a station house bathroom. Defense lawyers will pick up after the trial's most explosive testimony on Thursday. Former officer Justin Volpe testified that he was the only person who assaulted Abner Louima. Volpe's pleaded guilty in the attack, and he's serving a 30-year sentence. Another officer, Charles Schwarz, faces a possible life sentence after his 1999 conviction for violating Louima's civil rights by holding him down during the attack. Schwarz and two other officers are currently on trial for allegedly conspiring to conceal Schwarz's involvement. But Volpe says Schwarz wasn't even in the room.
The assassination of Malcolm X was an unfortunate tragedy. And it reveals that there are still numerous people in our nation who have degenerated to the point of expressing dissent through murder, and we haven't learned to disagree without being violently disagreeable.
I am Malcolm, I am spirit, in a chariot I do ride. I am here with Harriet Tubman, Martin King is at my side. You are now my angel, Betty, standing at the pearly gates. I will give you wings of freedom. You no longer have to wait. We believe in freedom. That is the one thing you should know. Here in heaven, we love freedom as above, so below. I am Malcolm, I am spirit.
The problem of the black people in America is inseparable from the problem of oppressed people all over the world. And until the leaders of black America realize that our problem is inseparable from the entire international problem, we will be considered a minority, will be considered an underdog, and we'll be begging for the things that we should have had when we were born. And we still won't have them.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman on this 35th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, killed in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, which is now a vast biotechnology facility of Columbia University. That song sung by Matt Jones, the SNCC Freedom singer, singing about Malcolm and Betty. Today is not only the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, it is also President's Day. And Ralph Nader is using President's Day to announce his bid for the presidency of the United States. He has a Washington news conference to announce that he's seeking the nomination of the Green Party, which champions environmental causes. Ralph Nader ran 4 years ago, attracting less than 1% of the vote and spending less than $5,000, all his own money, on the campaign. The 65-year-old lawyer first gained prominence taking on the auto industry. Using a network of nonprofit organizations, he's fought for campaign finance reform, environmental protection, and fair trade. Nader faces competition for the Green Party nomination from at least three other candidates, including Jello Biafra, lead singer for the Dead Kennedys. In 1966, W.R. Murphy, president of Campbell Soup Company, said of Ralph Nader's campaign for auto safety, "It's of the same order of the hula hoop, a fad. 6 months from now, we'll probably be on another kick." Well, it is now almost 35 years later, and Ralph Nader is continuing his run for the presidency. Again, he ran in 1992 and ran in 1996, but this, he says, will be his first full bid, putting a great deal of resources into a run for the presidency. I had a chance to talk with him just a few minutes ago in this exclusive interview he did with Democracy Now! Before his announcement. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader.
Thank you, Amy.
So you want to be president. Why?
Today announcing that I'm seeking the Green Party nomination for president in order to emphasize a pro-democracy campaign and to recognize that many of the problems in this country cannot be resolved without specific strengthening of the tools of democracy in all the roles that we play, whether as voters and citizens, with public financing of campaigns, whether as workers, strengthening the labor laws, whether as taxpayers, whether as consumers, or whether as communities who have to deal with the concentration of corporate power in almost every nook and cranny of our political economy.
Now, what exactly does this mean in terms of seeking the nomination of the Green Party? What is the process you will go through right now?
Well, the nomination of the Green Party has more than one candidate. I'm one of several candidates, and the convention will be in Denver in the third week of June. It will be decided at that time. There's also a very, very difficult ballot access hurdle in about 10 states, such as Texas and North Carolina and Georgia. And during the spring, the first order of work for all of us will be to try to get sufficient numbers of signatures on petitions in order to get on the ballot in those states where the two major parties have gone out of their way to obstruct third-party ballot access and competition to their control over the political process.
Ralph Nader, can you explain how this year is different from the two previous years that you made a bid for the presidency in 92 and 96?
Well, in 92, it wasn't really anything other than a none-of-the-above write-in campaign in New Hampshire and an attempt to try to get the major candidates running for office at that time to discuss corporate power matters and to discuss fundamental reforms and to broaden the public dialogue. And we did have very, very robust town meetings. Many of them were much larger than the candidates for the Democratic or Republican nomination. In 96, I was asked first by environmental groups in California and then other groups in other states simply to agree to have my name put on the ballot. And so I didn't really run for the office at all. I didn't campaign. I didn't raise any money. This time, the campaign will have resources. The campaign will try to get on as many states as possible. The campaign will rely on lots of volunteers as well as full-time staff. What we're trying to do is not just enhance the effectiveness and the growth of the Green Party, but also in so doing to open the way for very creative ideas about how to increase the political energies of the American people, how to advance the civic involvement of the American people, and how to fundamentally shift power from the concentration that now is in the hands of multinational corporations over our workplace, our marketplace, our environment, our governments, and even over our children in terms of corporate exploitation of the littlest Americans. For those who are interested in assisting the campaign, the address is Nader2000, P.O. Box 18002. That's 18002, Washington, D.C., 20036. And, of course, the website, which is www.votenader.com, www.votenader.com.
Do you have an 800 number?
No, we do not.
How many do you expect to get on the ballots in all states?
Certainly in 45 states or more. I think that some of the state ballot access laws are not just large numbers of signatures, such as 30,000 or 35 or 38,000 verified signatures. That requires getting almost double that number because the powers that be in one or both of the Republican Democratic parties who control this process picket the signatures, and they have all kinds of technical ways they can disqualify signatures. And in some states, you can't even sign the petition if you have participated or are going to register with another party. Only independents could sign these petitions. I think that with other third-party candidates, we have to make a concerted effort once and for all to reduce the highest ballot access obstacles of any democracy in the Western world. Far, far more onerous than, for example, our neighboring country in Canada.
We're talking to Ralph Nader. He's announcing for the nomination for president from the Green Party today on President's Day in Washington, D.C. Ralph, will you qualify for matching funds?
We intend to. The standard on that in the law is that if you raise $5,000 or more from each of 20 states in denominations of $250 or less, you can qualify for matching funds. We certainly will be striving to get that accomplished as soon as possible.
And you're planning to raise money?
Yes. We're of course, not taking any PAC money, but we will raise individual contributions up to the legal limit of $1,000 per contributor for the primary campaign and $1,000 for the general campaign. This money will not go, Amy, to political consultants. It's not going to go to expensive 30-second ads, where most of the money goes. It's going to be contributions from people who want to build a democracy and a more just society, and it will be used quite frugally.
Well, what do you think about the other candidates who you might be up against? Right now, we just came out of the South Carolina primary where Bush called himself the reformer with results. McCain had been going on that platform of reformer. He's been pushing campaign finance reform. Is this the kind of campaign finance reform you support?
Well, his support is very limited for campaign finance reform. He does want to eliminate soft money, which is a burgeoning new era of unlimited financial abuse by the rich and powerful. But he doesn't want public financing of campaigns, which is rather strange. You have abuse in one area, and he doesn't think there's sufficient abuse in another to prevent the perpetration of a system where our election campaigns, our public campaigns, are basically put up for auction to the highest bidders, mostly business money. And public campaigns should be publicly financed. They can be publicly financed by well-promoted voluntary checkoffs. Example, on the 1040 tax return, up to $100 per person if they so choose to check off. Plus, free time on television and radio, which, after all, uses public property, the public airways, for transacting the business of a very, very lucrative industry called the broadcasting industry.
Well,
President Clinton has continually supported campaign finance reform in a limited way with a lot of rhetoric and very little political muscle. He started doing this in 1992, and every State of the Union message had a sentence saying, he wanted Congress to enact campaign finance reform, but he never made it a high priority. It was just a lot of talk. And, of course, this allowed him and others to go all the way, raising as much money from special interests as they could possibly raise.
Will you be disclosing your own tax returns?
We will, of course, comply with all FEC regulations, and that means you file disclosure forms. And under the Government Ethics Act, all candidates have to disclose information. I have never believed that tax returns should ever be made public. They are a private matter between the taxpayers in this country and the U.S. Treasury. But the Government Ethics Law does require sufficient disclosure to fulfill the purposes of that policy.
Tonight, Ralph Nader, there'll be a debate in New York at the Apollo Theater between the Democratic candidates Bill Bradley and Al Gore. Al Gore, in the last few days, told union leaders one thing about whether China should enter the World Trade Organization, then told business leaders another. The White House was very concerned about him being critical of this. Can you tell us your stand on this issue?
Well, anything that makes the World Trade Organization stronger, I'm opposed to. I want the United States to initiate the 6 months notice of withdrawal from the World Trade Organization so that global trade agreements or multilateral trade agreements or bilateral trade agreements can be conducted in a way that pull up standards of living, not that pull down standards of living to lowest common denominators abroad, such as the massive use of child labor products made in brutalized conditions that move in international trade avenues. China, if it comes into the World Trade Organization, will strengthen the World Trade Organization. And for that reason alone, many of us are opposed to its entry. There are other reasons, of course, as well, that have been widely publicized, but one that hasn't, which is anything that strengthens the World Trade Organization also strengthens the forces of autocracy and the corporate model of economic development, or shall we say destruction, which is spread throughout the Third World to the disadvantage of people who are extremely impoverished in those areas. The UNCTAD report, the United Nations agency, reported recently that 45 of the poorer countries in the world are worse off today because of the World Trade Organization and the domination of Western corporations in setting the terms of trade. And UNCTAD and the UN are for the World Trade Organization. So it was contrary to their own preference, and they still came out that it was bad for dozens of these nations.
Ralph Nader announcing his candidacy for President of the United States. We'll be back with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we continue our exclusive interview with Ralph Nader, really minutes before he announces his candidacy for presidency of the United States. Ralph Nader, what about the issue of health care?
Very simply, what we need in this country at long, long last is full Medicare for everybody in the country, from cradle through nursing home. And that has been accomplished in Canada, even though the Canadian system has been underinvested by some of the federal governments, even though it's being undermined by U.S. and Canadian private companies who are hovering like vultures to pick off a slice of that business, it still is the best health care financing system in the world. And the evidence for that is quite compelling. There are other universal health care systems in Western Europe, Japan, and we're the only nation left without a universal health system, health financing system. And, of course, every year, despite so-called prosperity of our economy, more and more Americans do not have any health care insurance. It's closing in on 50 million Americans, including millions of children. Now, the Canadians cover everybody in health care for about 10 to 11% of their economy. We're spending this year almost 15% of our economy, and almost 50 million people are not covered, many more undercovered, and many more who are covered are anxious because they may fall through the cracks with increasing co-payments, deductions, exclusions, pre-existing conditions, and all the nightmare of bill collecting complexities that take 24 cents out of every health care dollar for administration, bill collecting and other administrative expenses. In Canada, it's only about 11% of the health care dollar for administration. So I think we got to be very clear, very compelling, very comprehensive, and not just focus on the financing of health care, but improve the quality of health care to reduce the enormous casualty toll from so-called medical mistakes and the enormous casualty toll from outright medical malpractice, and also to make sure that any universal system is supervised adequately for its beneficiaries, we need ways to empower the creation of consumers' organizations that specialize in health care on a state-by-state basis to watchdog the whole effort.
But how do you actually accomplish passing universal health care? I mean, you'd have a Congress that was not at all like you. You'd be dealing with Democrats and Republicans who already have been fighting against universal health care for quite a long time.
Well, what you do is form a mass citizen movement. Certainly, there's a huge preference among unorganized millions of Americans for universal health care. And the only way it's going to happen is for organizations in each congressional district. I mean, even during 1993 struggle over health care in the early years of the Clinton administration, about 120 members of Congress supported a single-payer universal health care plan. And in that year, I don't think there were 20 full-time organizers in the United States of America pressing for universal health care. You don't get anywhere in terms of a basic change like that without mobilizing full-time organizers and mobilizing the citizenry into a highly focused effort to get it through Congress. So we haven't begun to use a fraction of the civic power that is latently behind this important transformation of the health care sector of our society. And it's not going to happen without that kind of effort. And I think the Green Party and other allied forces are going to try to mobilize that kind of support.
Speaking of health care, where do you stand on the issue of women's right to choose?
Well, I don't think government should require a woman to have a child or not to have a child. It is what is called beyond the effective limits of legal action. It's in a way like trying to enforce prohibition in the 20s. It doesn't work that way. That issue of abortion is a moral matter between the woman and her counsel, her advisors, and it's in the realm outside, I think, of the legal system.
Well, what would you say to those who see this as an absolutely key issue and who are afraid that if a Republican like George W. Bush were elected, or McCain for that matter, that they would put someone on the Supreme Court that would tip the balance on Roe v. Wade and that would be the end of it, and that Gore or Bradley would put someone on the court that was for a woman's right to choose, and that you would be taking away the vote of the Democrat?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that the effort to overturn Roe v. Wade will be an extremely politically disadvantageous effort to the Republican Party. Many of the Republican Party operatives know that. That's why they're very cagey about this subject matter, given the majority opinion in this country. It's not likely that the Republican Party is going to destroy its future electoral prospects over an attempt to reverse Roe v. Wade. Even if Roe v. Wade was reversed, it's very unlikely that any states could muster the sustained effort to revert the situation back to the state of back alley illegalities. So I think that it's not a likely concern that even the party that is least friendly to this issue is going to go forward with its occasional political rhetoric.
What about that overall issue, though, of while people may be sympathetic to your stands and your positions more so than the Democrats or Republicans, the fear that, and this would be for people who would either vote for you or for the Democrats, assuming that you draw mainly away from the Democrats, that their vote is then for you is basically a vote for the Republicans.
Well, that's the least of the worst argument. And for 35 years, we've been watching the least of the worst emerge, where the passage of every 4 years makes both of them and the two major parties worse. I mean, you can't have a progressive political movement be held hostage by that kind of argument. Now, any votes that I might get, the Democrats can battle for with more progressive policies. They can look to the progressive arena and start taking stands on corporate power and corporate crime and corporate welfare and try to enlarge their base. If they don't do that, they deserve to shrink. In the past, in our country, third parties moved the major parties, and sometimes, of course, the third parties elected governors and senators and almost elected a president, a populist progressive, period. It's the acme of political arrogance, basically, for the Democrats to say, don't have any political movements that are called progressive because you might help elect the Republicans. As we know, the two parties are converging more and more on more of the basic issues of public policy. So that in many ways they look alike and they're very indistinguishable, and they're both feeding from the same corporate trough. The other point that certainly can be made is that the Democrats want to recapture the House. And since there aren't many Green Party candidates for the House of Representatives, if we help get a larger turnout of voters, they're going to be likely to vote for the Democrats in terms of the House of Representatives column. But the Democrats simply have to understand that they have turned their back on many issues that earlier Democratic parties gave credence to, and they have become part of one giant corporate party with two heads wearing different makeup, and we call that the Dem Rep Party.
Your stand, Ralph Nader, on the death penalty?
Well, for many years, going back to law school, I was against the individual death penalty. I think the corporate death penalty, by withdrawing corporate charters for brutalizing behavior by corporations, such as systemic contamination of people's communities, is certainly in order, and there was such a penalty in the 19th century. But the individual death penalty has been shown again and again not to be a deterrent, to be extremely biased in its application toward minorities, to present serious risks of executing innocent people. In fact, 13 people on death row in Illinois have been released in 87 because later evidence proved their innocence even after they were convicted of a capital crime. And any government that purports to seek the reduction of violence has got to practice the reduction of violence. This doesn't mean that these convicted criminals are going to be out in the streets, they're going to be incarcerated for life, and they are going to be subjected to intensive examination in terms of how they committed their crimes, and much more will be known about the sources of criminal conduct.
How do you plan on getting your message out in the corporate media through the very corporations that you're so critical of?
Well, that's difficult because as Ben Bagdikian's new book on the media monopoly shows, the acceleration of concentration of media in fewer conglomerate hands has even outpaced his predictions. In previous editions of this book, Media Monopoly, that is published by Beacon Press in Boston, Massachusetts, I think part of it is an opportunity to get through the progressive media, such as Pacifica Radio, public radio. I think if our campaign runs with viable and effective citizen groups and local communities surrounding issues that have already been publicized, the local media will give some attention to it. I think the Internet website, which I mentioned, is votenator.com, will become a thriving source of information back and forth to many people who use the Internet. I think there are a lot of community newspapers that will publicize the positions and the activities. And the major media gives you usually one or two rounds, like the New York Times or Washington Post, at least. And we hope to try and get in on the presidential debates, which, as most people know, is a run by a commission completely created and dominated by the Republican Democratic parties and funded by corporate money, from tobacco money to auto money to Budweiser. Imagine a beer company is forking over half $1 million to fund the presidential debate that's going to occur in October in St. Louis. But, of course, even if we don't get on the presidential debate, this doesn't stop any television network from having its own debate. And I think there are citizen groups, some of which are allied with Paul Taylor, who are demanding that the mass electronic media provide adequate time for candidates to express their sense of political direction for the country.
How will you get it? And what's your strategy for trying to get into the official presidential debate?
Well, as you know, there'll be a flurry of lawsuits. The criteria for the presidential debate is any candidate who gets 15% or more in the polls by six designated mass media polling organizations affiliated with the three major networks, with CNN, with the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, etc., gets on the debate. Well, of course, that's almost a circular process, isn't it? If the major media doesn't cover candidate X, Y, or Z, then its subsidiary polling company is not going to register a very high polling result. And that was a very clever and not very subtle way for the Presidential Debate Commission to reserve the presidential debates for its two major candidates. I think there'll be a flurry of lawsuits. Maybe public opinion might change it, but it is possible that some third-party candidates will break through the 15%. These are times of rapid change.
In terms of your official organization around the country, because that's what people are going to be looking at to decide whether to throw in their lot with you and actually get active about how serious you are, how much will you be on the road, and how are you going to organize state by state in terms of staffs and people getting out there?
Well, we're going to have regional coordinators full-time, and then we're going to look for volunteers full-time in various states. I'll be going into most of the states. We want to have core events with the Green Party activists and newcomers to the Green Party. We're going to have a whole series of events in early March in California where we're going to make a major effort. Last time, without any campaigning, I got over 260,000 votes in California, and we see that as a major state for our efforts. We also want to do, at the same time, local media. We want to do some fundraising for the party itself. And we want to make sure that the days before the election, there are voting precincts people who focus on getting out the vote. That's often forgotten in third-party efforts. There has to be a very, very close and focused emphasis on precinct organizations to get out the vote. We want to try to get 5% of the vote in order to achieve a level of impact by the Green Party so that it can begin to affect the margins of victory and defeat between the two major parties at the national level and to begin winning right out at the local and state level for various candidacies that are now beginning to proliferate on the part of Green Party candidates all over the country. Hartford City Councilwoman Elizabeth Sheff has been elected as a Green Party member just recently in Santa Monica, California. There are two members of the Santa Monica Council, and in other places around the country, we want to encourage more and more candidates to come forward. And that's why the website is so important, because we want to see which candidates will come forward and hear from them and exchange information from them so that the grassroots basis of the Green Party becomes more and more firmly established.
Do you think you could possibly win the presidency of the United States?
Needless to say, it's an uphill fight to attain a significant party status. But as I have said, we're going to try to make sure that we have a political system in this country that's congenial to small starts, because like the natural world, if political seeds are not allowed to grow into plants, as in nature, politics simply won't get regenerated. It will implode on itself as it has been. So, rather than make predictions, we'll leave it up to the voters, and we'll recognize that historically progressive movements have taken more than 4 years to take root, but take root they will when the excesses of concentrated power get out of hand. Amy, I think it was best said by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis years ago when he made this statement, and I quote, "We can have a democratic society, or we can have great concentrated wealth in the hands of a few. We cannot have both."
And again, if people want to get in touch with your organization, is there any kind of phone number, even if not an 800 number?
Well, there will be a phone number very shortly, but right now the best thing for them to do is to log in to www.votenator.com. The phone number will be posted very soon, or to write us at Nader 2000, P.O. Box 18002, Washington, D.C., 20036.
Thanks for being with us, Ralph Nader.
You're welcome.
Ralph Nader announcing today he will seek the Green Party nomination for president. And you heard it exclusively on Democracy Now!, just another reason to listen. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, an incredible story about what happened in the hours after Amadou Diallo was killed. We'll speak with his roommate. Stay with us.
My condolences to Mr. and Mrs. Diallo and family.
are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Malcolm X, it's the 35th anniversary of his assassination. Today we're going to talk about the death of another man, Amadou Diallo. There was an article in the New York Daily News on March 7th of 1999, and I want to go through the first few paragraphs. We really pretty much never heard it mentioned again, and definitely didn't hear it mentioned in the trial so far. This is how it goes. In the hours after Amadou Diallo was shot to death on his doorstep, his tiny apartment was secretly searched by teams of police officers who dumped out two wardrobes of clothing, tore drapes from his bedroom window, and upended beds. At the same time, his roommates, roused from sleep by the police to identify his bullet-riddled corpse, were being held at the 43rd Precinct Station House, where they were interrogated for more than 6 hours. They were not told that Diallo had been killed by other police officers. Neither the searches nor the interrogations are mentioned in a report written by Deputy Inspector Stephen Silk, a ranking police officer on the scene that night. Another senior police official who would not speak for attribution confirmed that the apartment was searched and the roommates questioned. The police actions fit into a chilling pattern of events that began within minutes of the shooting and only now is becoming clear. While no questions of any kind were put to the four officers who shot Diallo, the dead man's home and background were exhaustively probed. The first officers to search the apartment and question the roommates were from the street crime unit, the same unit as the four cops who shot Diallo. SCU officers arrived within a minute of the shooting after hearing about it on point-to-point radio communications, which are not recorded. Members of the street crime unit usually do not participate in investigations, and about an hour after the shooting, they were ordered to leave the scene, sources say. That night, police checked to see if Diallo had an arrest record. He did not. Investigators also pulled records to see if any narcotics busts had been made at 1157 Wheeler Ave during the past 18 months, or if there had been arrests for any reason in the year before. They found none. No blemish was found in Diallo's background, and the relevance of such research to the shooting is not clear. Asked why the police would have an interest in the dead man's apartment, the senior official said the purpose was to uncover, quote, anything that could shed light on Mr. Diallo's activity prior to his encounter with the police. This investigation, the ransacking of the apartment, the taking of the roommates to the precinct station house, the questioning of them about whether Amadou Diallo had any enemies, was not told in the trial. And on Saturday night, Democracy Now! Technical Director Errol Maitland and I and another friend, Reem, went to Diallo's apartment building to see for ourselves what the scene looked like. And as we were standing there, we met Amadou Diallo's roommate and close friend, family friend from Guinea. His name is Abdourahman Diallo. He was 22 years old, as Amadou Diallo was when Diallo was killed, and he now joins us in the studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Abdourahman.
Hi. Thank you for having me here, and I'm very happy for. And
well, we're very glad that you were able to come in today. And first, condolences, although this is more than a year later, on the loss of your friend and roommate, Amadou.
Let's
go back to that night and what happened. When Amadou was shot, where were you?
I was sleeping in the room. Like I said before, that day I came from work like 4, and I went to bed. I was having a headache, you know, and I sleep 4 to midnight, then I heard about banging of the door, and I thought that it's my roommate who came back from work, maybe he lost his key, and I went up in the door, and I saw a police officer lying in the vestibule. I said, wow. I said, what's going on? Because I don't know, we never have any crime, you know, or anyone in the apartment who gonna be arrested for something, because I know all of us, we're not dealing with the bad stuff to being arrested. And they was pushing me in the room, asking me my identification. Those police officers all come to the apartment to investigate. And they asked me if I have a light. I put the light on, and they're asking me, what's your name, where you from, and those kind of things. I told them with a respect, because I know the police officer. I have to respect them, know what they come, you know where they came from, why they came here in that night. And I told them my identification. Then I wait. They said that we have to go outside. I said, well, I asked them what's going on. That time I don't know what is, you know, what is going on, what is up or down.
You didn't know that Amadou had been shot?
No. I don't know Amadou was having shot. And like I said, I was asking them what's going on. They didn't tell me that time. They just want me to go out with them.
Were they wearing uniform?
No. They was plain clothes officer. I think there are five police officers who went
to your apartment?
Yeah.
And they were taking your roommate as well? Mamadou?
No, that man was sleeping.
Mamadou was sleeping.
That time he was sleeping in the bedroom. I'm the first guy waking up with those police officers. And like I said, they take me to the vestibule. I saw the Lalo was crying over there, and I knew directly somebody had been shot, but I don't know who. And the time they was taking me out, and I went to the door. The time they was opening the door, I saw that man lying down there. I fall down, and directly I grab another police officer. I say, where this man have been shot? Where do you find him? They said they don't know, and I went back to the apartment. I called my uncle and the parents of Amadou, that I told them the man have been, you know.
You called Amadou's parents in Guinea?
No, not direct, not that time. And I think after, like, the next day, we have, the, you know, we called them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but.
What did Amadou's body, as he lay there in the vestibule?
Yeah, I think 5 hours.
What did he look like? Could you see that he was shot?
Yeah. I saw the blood, you know, the blood was all over his body, and he was have, you know, you can see the bullet in his stomach.
His shirt was ripped open?
Yeah. And it's very hard for me to, you know, still now that pain taking me, I mean, I'm having a headache with it. And
so you went back into the apartment?
Yeah.
And the police then took you again?
Yeah, the time I went back to the apartment, they was asking me, where's the Amadou room? I said, I'm living with the guy in the same room. And it's very hard to me to say that.
Sorry. We're talking to Abdourahman Diallo, and he is a cousin of Amadou Diallo. He came to the United States a month after Amadou came, and they lived in the same room at 1157 Wheeler Avenue with another roommate. That roommate did testify at the trial. Although Abdourahman thought he would be testifying, they didn't call him. Now, when we heard his roommate testify, we never heard the prosecution talk about these events that took place.
Yeah.
Abdourahman, you went back, and then the police said they were taking you to the precinct along with your roommate.
Yeah.
And so what happened when they took you there? What kinds of questions did they ask you?
They was asking us about Amadou life, and if the man have an enemy, if I know who did that to him.
Wait a second. They asked you if you knew who shot him?
Who shot him? I said, I don't know. I was sleeping in the room. And it's very hard to me. I'm still not believing those officers did not tell me that the man have been shot by officer, you know. Another police officer, but...
So you were held for more than 6 hours. They asked you if he had any enemies?
Yeah.
And they asked you about his background?
Yeah.
Did they ask you whether he took drugs or...?
Yeah, they was asking me those kind of questions. And like I said, I don't still believe it, that because I was good to those officers because I want to know who shot my friend, you know. I thought that in the first time those officers, they was helping me to find the man who shot the guy, you know, my roommate. But in the end, I find that they was trying to get us, you know, trying to take a point with us for Ahmadu life, you know. But still now, though, even one police officer did not tell me that the man had been shot by police officer. It's a lady who told me, I think it's a News 12, that's called me home and tell me that the man had been shot by police officer.
After you came home?
After I came back home, like 8:30 in the morning, the same day.
So this was about 8 hours later. The police never told you?
They never told me.
They just asked you questions about Jallo. And did he have enemies?
Yeah.
Now, why would they want to know if he had enemies if they had shot him?
Maybe to get away with it. Because when they know that the man have, like, bad acting or he sell drug or those kind of things, they're going to say he's a criminal man and they're going to get away with it. And I don't still not believe in that. They're not telling us that men have been shot by police officers. It's very hard for me.
So for 8 hours you were questioned by the police. You went home, and it was only then that you learned that it was police officers who had killed him.
Yeah.
Were the police still around at home?
Yeah. They were still around over there and asking me. I think they interviewed me like 10 times with the radio. They was having a radio. They was recording what I was saying.
You mean a tape recorder?
Yeah.
All through that night, there was
all through that night, there was questioning me and recording, and, you know.
So there would have been a tape to play at the trial if the prosecution had so chosen.
Mm-hmm. And it's very hard for me.
When you walked out of the apartment and saw your roommate and friend Amadou, did you see his wallet?
In the place where it was the body, I don't see the wallet over there. The wallet was not over there. And like I said, I fall down to his body and I grab him. That means I saw all his, you know, all what he got on him because I don't see no wallet. I just saw the bullet on his stomach and his leg was crossing. I mean, eyes open and I still, it's terrible for me, believe me.
Amadou was in the vestibule, and there were a series of steps, not very high, that goes onto the street. When we talked in front of your apartment on Saturday night, you said the wallet was down at the bottom of the steps. Is that right?
Yeah. I saw the wallet over there, but I don't know who removed him. They said in the court that they didn't remove the wallet on his hand.
Where did Amadou keep his keys?
I mean, Amadou keep his key in the first time that I knew him. His key was, in the wallet.
You mean there was a ring in the wallet?
In the wallet, yeah. In the wallet, he used to fix his key inside. Like I said, that man was having opinion to open the door, you know.
He was trying to open the door.
He was trying to open the door. The wallet, he fixed his key in the wallet. That means when he get his wallet, it's to open the door, not to show us something.
Mm. Abdourahman Diallo, the show is coming to an end now, but we are going to tape the rest of this conversation and play it tomorrow. Tomorrow is closing arguments for the Diallo murder trial in Albany, but this will be the beginning of our program, is the rest of your story. It's quite an amazing one. Again, to summarize, the police, just after the shooting of Amadou Diallo, took his roommates for more than 6 hours to the police station and questioned them about who could have killed Amadou Diallo. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I am here with Harriet Tubman. Martin King is at my side.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Metlin, our technical director. And thank you to Reem Kakudu.
I will give you wings of freedom. You no longer